Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start with an article on the jobs report, and as we go through the article, you'll see why it is such a big deal and such a major story at present. This is from Fortune magazine. It's by Jason Ma, dated August 2nd. Shockingly bad jobs report reveals a months-long stall and may trigger federal rate cuts soon. Powell is going to regret holding rates steady. The U.S. labor market looks much weaker than previously thought, and Wall Street now expects the Federal Reserve to resume rate cuts sooner rather than later. The Labor Department reported Friday that payrolls grew by just 73,000 last month, well below forecasts for about 100,000. But the downward revisions for prior months shocked investors even more, revealing that the labor market came to a near standstill over the spring. May's tally was cut from 144,000 to 19,000, and June's total was slashed from 147,000 to just 14,000, resulting in a combined cut of 258,000 jobs. The average gain over the past 3 months is now only 35,000. The massive revisions prompted President Donald Trump to fire the head of the federal agency that puts out the payroll data. Erica Entefar, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The data report was so bad that Eric Pachman, Chief Analytics Officer at Bang Creek Capital Advisors, noted that while July's 73,000 looked comparatively good news, how can we even trust this number now? The jobs report came just days after the Fed kept rates steady again, with Chair Jerome Powell signaling a continued desire to wait for more data to see how President Donald Trump's tariffs would impact inflation, which is still running above the central bank's 2% target. Powell is going to regret holding rates steady this week, Jamie Cox, managing partner at Harris Financial Group, said in a note. September is a lock for a rate cut, and it might even be a 50 basis point move to make up for lost time. The unemployment rate also edged up to 4.2% from 4.1%, even as the labor force shrank. Meanwhile, U.S. factories continued to slump and cut 11,000 jobs last month after shedding 15,000 in June and 11,000 in May, amid uncertainty over Trump's tariff war. Stocks plummeted on the jobs data, with the S&P 500 down 1.6% and the NASDAQ down 2.2%. The 10-year Treasury yield sank more than 15 basis points to 4.208% as Wall Street priced in a rate cut at the Fed's meeting for next month and more later in the year. The yield on the 2-year Treasury, which is more sensitive to Fed rates, plunged almost 27 basis points. Markets were slumping before the jobs data, as Trump announced fresh tariff rates on U.S. trading partners, with some higher than before, as well as an additional 40% duty on all transshipped goods. After the jobs report, Trump reiterated his months-long demand for the Fed to lower rates, while Cleveland Fed President Beth Hammack stood by the central bank's decision on Wednesday to keep policy steady. Still, Wall Street noted that the revisions put the labor market in a starkly different light, after it looked remarkably resilient since Trump launched his trade war. Other analysts noted that other details don't suggest there's a total collapse in employment. The unemployment rate hasn't changed much for a while. Wages are still growing at a healthy clip, putting more money in consumers' wallets. Meanwhile, weekly job claims data has been steady overall too, meaning there hasn't been a widespread surge in layoffs. A critical question is whether the muted job gains are the results of a slow labor supply or slow demand. Supply has taken a big hit since Trump launched his immigration crackdown, and Friday's payroll report showed that the number of foreign-born workers in the labor force has shrunk by 1.2 million in the past 6 months, As a result, even a tepid uptick in hiring will barely move the needle on the jobless rate. In fact, Powell suggested on Wednesday that the unemployment rate merits closer attention than the payroll number, since less demand is needed to offset supply. Whether supply or demand is the culprit has major implications for the Fed, according to Breston Caldwell, chief U.S. economist at Morningstar. The Fed has no reason to loosen monetary policy in response to a decline in job growth driven by labor supply. As such, a decline is neither deflationary nor does it create a gap with respect to maximum sustainable employee, he wrote in a note. On the other hand, the speed of the deceleration in job growth, along with uncertainty about what exactly the data means, should be alarming to the Fed, and argues strongly for a September cut as a prophylactic measure at the very least. But Bill Adams, chief economist for Comerica Bank, noted that Trump's tariffs are still putting upward pressure on inflation, making it less clear-cut that the Fed will ease policy soon. He also pointed to labor supply, specifically, that the overall labor force has fallen for 3 consecutive months. Federal policymakers will see another jobs report before their September meeting. If it shows labor supply declined again and held the unemployment rate steady while tariffs push up inflation, the Fed is likely to hold interest rates steady again, Adams wrote in a note. So, you may ask, what are some of the ramifications of a weak jobs report? Here's one of them. This is an article from Fortune by Jim Edwards, dated August 3rd. The dollar is being punished for the jobs data that revealed how weak the U.S. economy really was. The dollar, which has lost value all year against foreign currencies, has been making a comeback in recent weeks. But Friday's job numbers from the BLS and the downward revisions to previous numbers that accompanied it knocked the stuffing out of the dollar's rally, ING says. The U.S. dollar fell off a cliff on Friday after the Bureau of Labor Statistics dramatically revised downward its estimates of how many jobs the American economy was creating. The economy, it turned out, was far weaker than everyone had assumed. The dollar has lost value all year. It is currently down nearly 9% to date against the DXY, an index of foreign currencies, as investors flee Donald Trump's tariff barriers. In June, the USD hit a low of more than 10%, but in recent weeks, the dollar has been gaining ground. Until Friday, the dollar fell from 100.22 on the DXY on Friday to 98.82 this morning, a relatively large move for a currency the size of a dollar. The dollar index suffered its biggest one-day drop since May 23rd, as markets swiftly reassessed the outlook for rates and growth, George Vesey of Convera told clients in a note. In his note to clients, ING analyst Chris Turner called it the dollar's handbrake turn. Friday's soft job report knocked the stuffing out of the dollar's rally. Investors now attach an 80% probability to a 25 basis point rate cut from the Federal Reserve in September, he wrote. Uncertainty about the quality of U.S. data is not a good look for U.S. asset markets and could add some more risk premium both into the dollar and treasuries. Goldman Sachs called it USD Whiplash Week. By the way, USD means U.S. dollar. The bank also published a subdued note from chief economist John Hatzius that forecast U.S. GDP growth would be only 1% in the second half of the year. His colleague, Kamakshaya Trivedi, argued that although the media narrative suggested that Trump had somehow won deals that were negative for U.S.'s trading partners, most foreign exports, which go to other countries, won't be affected. We expect that the U.S. will bear most of the cost of the tariffs, which will weigh on its terms of trade. This is partly because of the breadth of the tariff increases, which will make it difficult for U.S. firms and consumers to find suitable substitutes, he wrote. That's why the dollar is so much weaker on foreign exchanges this morning. Now we're going to do a quick article on something that probably will have no effect on any of us, unless you're very, very lucky. It's by Zachary Folk. It's from Fortune magazine, dated August 3rd. The title of the article is Powerball Jackpot Reaches $426 Million. Here's what the winner could take home after taxes. Here's the main point to remember. The Powerball jackpot ticked up to $426 million after no winners were drawn Saturday night. But a lucky winner or winners would take home substantially less after paying federal and state taxes on their winnings. Winners from Monday's upcoming drawing could get either $426 million in installments or a lump sum of $193.5 million, but that would get slashed significantly after taxes. No tickets were sold matching all of Saturday's numbers, raising the jackpot again for Monday's upcoming drawing. If a winner is drawn Monday, they will have the option of either accepting the $426 million prize spread out over 30 annualized payments, or take the lump sum of $193.5 million, which is the more popular option for winners. However, a federal withholding tax of 24% is applied to that jackpot, bringing the winnings down to $323.7 million, or $147 million for the lump sum. The winnings are then taxed based on the winner's income, which could rise as high as 37% for Americans in the highest tax bracket, bringing the final winnings for the lump sum down to $121.9 million. State taxes then reduce this jackpot even further, with New York bringing the highest rate at 10.9%, though some states, such as California, Florida, and Texas, do not tax winnings. The next drawing is scheduled Monday night at 10:59 Eastern Daylight Time. To step outside the article for just a second, here's the number that you need to remember if you want to play the Powerball. Okay, back to the article. The odds for winning the Powerball jackpot are 1 in 292.2 million, according to the lottery organizers. The odds of winning the $1 million prize with a ticket that matches five numbers without the Powerball number are 1 in 11.6 million. And as a final fact, here's a big number, $526 million. That's how much a lucky winner in California got after purchasing a winning ticket in March. Because that player won in the Golden State, they did not have to pay state taxes on those winnings. If you're worried about losing your job to AI, here's an article that'll give you some information about whether your particular job type may be under threat. It's by Preston Foer. It's from Fortune magazine, dated August 3rd. Microsoft researchers have revealed the 40 jobs most exposed to AI, and even teachers make the list. As companies like Amazon publicly announce AI-driven workforce reductions, workers are scrambling to understand which careers might soon disappear and be outsourced to technology. A new report from Microsoft researchers studying the occupational implications of generative AI offers some clarity. Translators, historians, and writers are among the roles with the highest AI applicability score, meaning the job's tasks are most closely aligned with AI's current abilities, according to the report released this month that ranked professions. Customer service and sales representatives, which make up about 5 million jobs in the United States, will also have to compete with AI. Overall, the jobs most exposed are ones that involve knowledge work, like people doing computer, math, or administrative work in an office, the researchers wrote. Sales jobs are also high on the list, since they often involve sharing and explaining information. While Microsoft said high applicability doesn't automatically mean that these jobs will necessarily be replaced by AI, the list of roles quickly went viral, with professionals deeming them most at risk. It comes as companies like IBM have been freezing thousands of would-be new roles that it expects AI will take over in the next 5 years, and graduates in the UK are facing the worst job market since 2018 as employers pause hiring and use AI to cut costs, says Indeed. Of course, there are some jobs that are unlikely to be touched by AI: dredge operators, bridge and lock tenders, and water treatment plant and system operators are among the jobs with virtually no generative AI exposure, thanks in part to their hands-on equipment requirements. Still, business leaders like NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang have said that every job will be touched by AI in some way, so it's best to embrace it. Every job will be affected, and immediately, it is unquestionable, Huang said at the Milken Institute's global conference in May. You're not going to lose your job to an AI, but you're going to lose your job to someone who uses AI. Many of the jobs with high chances of getting upended by AI soon, like political scientists, journalists, and management analysts, are all ones that typically require a 4-year degree to land a job. And as the researchers point out, having a degree which was once considered a surefire path to career advancement is no longer a safeguard against the changing tides. In terms of education requirements, we find higher AI applicability for occupations requiring a bachelor's degree than occupations with lower requirements, wrote the researchers, who studied 200,000 real-world conversations of Copilot users and cross-compared the AI's performance with occupational data. On the flip side, there are some career paths with low AI exposure that are growing in demand. The healthcare sector in particular is an area that's experiencing this heavily. The home health and personal care aid industry is expected to create the greatest number of new jobs over the next decade, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor. At the same time, the researchers recognize that even their findings don't capture the full scope of the AI revolution, and there could be further automation caused by more than just generative technology. Our measurement is purely about LLMs. Other applications of AI could certainly affect occupations involving operating and monitoring machinery, such as truck driving. Kieran Tomlinson, a senior Microsoft researcher, tells Fortune the study focused on highlighting where AI might change how work is done, not take away or replace jobs. Our research shows that AI supports many tasks, particularly those involving research, writing, and communication, but does not indicate it can fully perform any single occupation. As AI adoption accelerates, it's important that we continue to study and better understand its societal and economic impact, Tomlinson says. After seeing the roller coaster of layoffs across the tech industry over the past few years, many Generation Zers have turned to seemingly steadier fields like education. The sector was the fastest growing industry among recent UK graduates last year, and it was similarly a top career choice for American graduates. And while the profession can provide further work-life balance and decent benefits, the ability for AI to do the work may cause further headaches. The report singles out farm and home management educators, as well as post-secondary economics, business, and library science teachers, as roles with relatively high AI applicability. Whether it's unlikely that schools will roll out AI teachers en masse, the report's findings underscore how quickly the technology could reshape the education profession and many others. Now, here are 10 top 10 least affected occupations by generative AI. We'll go through these quickly. Dredge operators, bridge and lock tenders, water treatment plant and system operators, foundry mold and core makers, rail track laying and maintenance equipment operators, pile driver operators, floor sanders and finishers, orderlies, motorboat operators, and logging equipment operators. Here, on the other hand, are the top 40 most affected occupations by generative AI. We're not going to do all 40. We're going to go through the top 15 very quickly. Interpreters and translators, historians, passenger attendants, sales representatives of services, writers and authors, customer service representatives, CNC tool programmers, telephone operators, ticket agents and travel clerks, broadcast announcers and radio DJs, brokerage clerks, farm and home management educators, telemarketers, concierges, and political scientists. You know, on second thought, here are five more. News analysts, reporters, journalists, mathematicians, technical writers, proofreaders and copy markers, and hosts and hostesses. Now we're going to talk Tesla, and it's a hard company to stay away from. In fact, we're going to do two articles on Tesla. One is about a jury award for $243 million about a Tesla autopilot crash. And the second is on Elon Musk's compensation package. Here's the first article. It's from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press. It was written by Bernard Condon and David Fisher. Title of the article is Jury's Order for Tesla to Pay $243 million in Autopilot Crash Will Send Shockwaves Through the Industry, analyst says. It's dated August 4th. A Miami jury decided that Elon Musk's car company, Tesla, was partly responsible for a deadly crash in Florida involving its autopilot driver assistant technology and must pay the victims more than $240 million in damages. A federal jury held that Tesla bore significant responsibility because its technology failed and that not all the blame can be put on a reckless driver. Even one who admitted he was distracted by his cell phone before hitting a young couple out gazing at the stars. The decision comes as Musk seeks to convince Americans that his cars are safe enough to drive on their own, as he plans to roll out a driverless taxi service in several cities in the coming months. The decision ends a four-year-long case, remarkable not just in its outcome, but that it even made it to trial. Many similar cases against Tesla have been dismissed, and when that didn't happen, settled by the company to avoid the spotlight of a trial. This will open the floodgates, says Miguel Custodio, a car crash lawyer not involved in the Tesla case. It will embolden a lot of people to come to court. The case also included startling charges by lawyers for the family of the deceased 22-year-old Nibel Benavides Leon and for her injured boyfriend Dylan Angulo. They claim Tesla either hid or lost key evidence, including data and video recorded seconds before the accident. Tesla said it made a mistake after being shown the evidence and honestly hadn't thought it was there. We finally learned what happened that night, that the car was actually defective, said Benavides' sister, Nima Benavides. Justice was achieved. Tesla has previously faced criticism that it is slow to cough up crucial data by relatives of other victims in Tesla crashes, accusations that the car company has denied. In this case, the plaintiff showed Tesla had the evidence all along, despite its repeated denials, by hiring a forensic data expert who dug it up. Today's verdict is wrong, Tesla said in a statement, and only works to set back automotive safety and jeopardize Tesla's and the entire industry's efforts to develop and implement life-saving technology. They said the plaintiffs concocted a story, blaming the car when the driver, from day one, admitted and accepted responsibility. In addition to a punitive award of $200 million, the jury said Tesla must also pay $43 million of a total $129 million in compensatory damages for the crash, bringing the total borne by the company to $243 million. It's a big number that will send shockwaves to others in the industry, said financial analyst Dan Ives of Wedbush Securities. It is not a good day for Tesla. Tesla said it will appeal. Even if that fails, the company says it will end up paying far less than what the jury decided. because of a pre-trial agreement that limits punitive damages to 3 times Tesla's compensatory damages. Translation, $172 million, not $243 million. But the plaintiffs say their deal was based on a multiple of all compensatory damages, not just Tesla's. And the figure that the jury awarded is one the company will have to pay. It's not clear how much of a hit to Tesla's reputation for safety the verdict in the Miami case will make. Tesla has vastly improved its technology since the crash on a dark rural road in Key Largo, Florida, in 2019. But the issue of trust generally in the company came up several times in the case, including closing arguments Thursday. The plaintiff's lead lawyer, Brett Schreiber, said Tesla's decision to even use the term autopilot showed it was willing to mislead people and take big risks with their lives because the system only helps drivers with lane changes, slowing a car, and other tasks, falling far short of driving the car itself. Schreiber said other automakers use terms like driver's assist and co-pilot to make sure drivers don't rely too much on the technology. Words matter, Schreiber said, and if someone is playing fast and loose with the words, they're playing fast and loose with information and facts. Schreiber acknowledged that the driver, George McGee, was negligent when he blew through flashing lights, a stop sign, at a T-intersection at 62 miles an hour before slamming into a Chevrolet Tahoe that left that the couple had parked to get a look at the stars. The Tahoe spun around so hard that it was able to launch Benavides 75 feet through the air into nearby woods where her body was later found. It left Angulo, who walked into the courtroom Friday with a limp and a cushion to sit on, with broken bones and a traumatic brain injury. But Schreiber said Tesla was at fault nonetheless. He said Tesla allowed drivers to act recklessly by not disengaging the autopilot as soon as they began to show signs of distraction and by allowing them to use the system on smaller roads that it was not designed for. The lead defense lawyer in the Miami case, Joel Smith, countered that Tesla warns drivers they must keep their eyes on the road and hands on the wheel, yet McGee chose not to do that while he looked for a dropped cell phone, adding to the danger by speeding, noting that McGee had gone through the same intersection 30 or 40 times previously and hadn't crashed during any of those trips. Smith said that isolated the cause to one thing alone. The cause is that he dropped his cell phone. The auto industry has been watching the case closely because a finding of Tesla liability, despite a driver's admission of reckless behavior, would pose significant legal risks for every company as they develop cars that increasingly drive themselves. Our second Tesla story concerns Elon Musk's compensation package, and it's a big one in case you were wondering. It's by Michelle Chapman with the Associated Press. The date of the article is August 3rd. The title of the article is Elon Musk, 6 months after the $56 billion pay package was struck down, wins a new one worth $29 billion from Tesla. Tesla is awarding CEO Elon Musk 96 million shares of restricted stock, valued at approximately $29 billion. Just 6 months after a judge ordered the company to revoke his massive pay package. The electric vehicle maker said in a regulatory filing on Monday that Musk must first pay Tesla $23.34 per share of restricted stock that vests, which is equal to the exercise price per share of the 2018 pay package that was awarded to the company's CEO. In December, Delaware Chancellor Kathleen St. Jude McCormick reaffirmed her earlier ruling that Tesla must revoke Musk's multi-billion dollar pay package. She found that Musk engineered the landmark pay package in sham negotiations with directors who were not independent. At the time, McCormick also rejected an equally unprecedented and massive fee request by plaintiff attorneys, who argued that they were entitled to legal fees in the form of Tesla stock. Sit back and relax, everybody. Wait till you hear the size of this legal fee. In the form of Tesla stock valued at more than $5 billion. The judge said the attorneys were entitled to a fee award of $345 million. The rulings came in a lawsuit filed by a Tesla stockholder who challenged Musk's 2018 compensation package. That pay package carried a potential maximum value of about $56 billion, but that sum has fluctuated over the years based on Tesla's stock price. Musk appealed the order in March. A month later, Tesla said in regulatory filings that it was creating a special committee to look at Musk's compensation as CEO. Tesla's shares have plummeted 25% this year, largely due to blowback over Musk's affiliation with President Donald Trump. But Tesla also faces intensifying competition from both the big Detroit automakers and from China. In its most recent quarter, Tesla reported that quarterly profits plunged from $1.39 billion to $409 million. Revenue also fell, and the company fell short of even the lowered expectations on Wall Street. Under pressure from shareholders last month, Tesla scheduled an annual shareholders meeting for November to comply with Texas state law. A group of more than 20 Tesla shareholders, which have watched Tesla shares plummet, said in a letter to the company that it needed to at least provide public notice of the annual meeting. Investors have grown increasingly worried about the trajectory of the company after Musk had spent so much time in Washington this year, becoming one of the most prominent officials in the Trump administration in its bid to slash the size of the U.S. government. Here's an article on United Healthcare. It's from Fortune magazine, written by Jeff Colvin, and dated August 2nd. The title of the article is, United Health Group Didn't Just Miss Earnings, It Did Something Far Worse. United Health Group, America's largest healthcare company, shocked investors Tuesday by reporting unexpectedly awful financial performance. It's the second consecutive quarter that the company has committed that sin. As a result, UHG is no longer just a company that missed its numbers. It's something much more rare, a huge enterprise, number 3 on the Fortune 500, confessing fundamental, long-standing problems endemic throughout the organization that may take years to remedy. The crisis first manifested in April. UHG was emerging from the trauma of executive Brian Thompson's high-profile murder in December, when the company released first-quarter profits far below Wall Street's expectations. The stock plunged, slashing over $100 billion from market value within hours. A month later, CEO Andrew Witty abruptly resigned for unspecified personal reasons, and former CEO Stephen Helmsley returned to the job. The stock plummeted again. The next day, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Department of Justice was investigating UHG for possible criminal Medicare fraud. The company said it hadn't been notified of any such investigation. The stock nosedived again. In less than a month, this corporate giant had lost more than half its value. This is a stock that every growth-oriented portfolio manager in the world owned for a decade, and it made money on it like clockwork, Whit Mayo, an analyst at the Leerink Healthcare Investment Bank, told Fortune at the time. It's stunning. It's unthinkable. On July 24th, 5 days before UHG's second quarter earnings release, the company acknowledged that the Justice Department was conducting civil and criminal investigation of the company over its Medicare billing practices. You can guess what the stock did. And then came the report of second quarter earnings. Now, after months of being pummeled by investors, regulators, and media, Helmsley has admitted that UHG needs an exhaustive stem-to-stern rehab, an extraordinarily audacious goal for an organization of some 400,000 employees. It's its stark acknowledgement of a deep and wide problem. How deep and how wide? Helmsley said UHG will change leadership, our businesses, our culture, approaches, practices, our board, governance, and succession oversight. Executives now beseech shareholders for patience, quite a change from 4 months ago, before $330 billion of market cap evaporated. Dr. Patrick Conway, CEO of Optum, one of UHG's two main divisions, now tells investors, "We know Optum's performance has not met expectations." Tim Noel, CEO of the other division, Insurance, says, "We're approaching our business with greater humility." Helmsley appears to be setting expectations low. He does say he doesn't see profit increasing at all this year. Next year, he sees solid but moderate earnings growth. Not until 2027 does he expect our earnings growth outlook strengthening quickly. Even that schedule may not allow enough time. When Helmsley returned as CEO in June, the board of directors gave him a one-time $60 million award of stock options that would vest after 3 years. That term seems lengthy for a 73-year-old whose objective was to right the ship. Now, after the latest quarter and highly ambitious, wide-ranging transformation he's attempting, investors may wonder if 3 years will be enough. Next is an article on Wall Street and crypto. It's from Fortune magazine, dated August 3rd by William Mugire. Title of the article is, "Wall Street is finally embracing crypto, but the real payoff will come when it embraces DeFi, which is decentralized finance." The global financial system, or what we broadly refer to as TradeFi, traditional finance, is a $30 trillion behemoth. Its reach spans commercial banking, global banking, assets, insurance, capital markets, wealth management, and asset servicing. It touches every person, business, and institution, underpinning how value flows throughout the world. Meanwhile, DeFi, decentralized finance, despite being the most transformational innovation to hit financial service in decades, remains a mere rounding error in that picture. Depending on how you measure it, via total value locked, TVL, DeFi token market cap, protocol revenue, or institutional activity, DeFi's footprint barely scratches $150 billion on a good day. That's less than 0.5% of TradeFi scope. This is not a failure. It is a testament to just how early we are. Seen more optimistically, it is an opening that holds the blueprint for the future of finance. Already, we've seen DeFi recreate core banking functions entirely on-chain, including borrowing, lending, insurance, trading, asset management, and structured products. And it's working. Millions of users, thousands of developers, and hundreds of projects are coalescing around this future. DeFi's growth, however, has been largely inward-looking, driven by crypto-native users rather than institutional money. And despite DeFi's rapid-fire innovation, leading TradeFi figures have been mostly elected to watch from the sidelines, or worse, confine themselves to dismissive skepticism. This underscores the need for a bridge between the old and the new. TradeFi must integrate with DeFi, not just observe it, not to co-opt it, but to scale it. Fortunately, there is a precedent for such integration. Consider BlackRock's game-changing embrace of Bitcoin's ETFs in 2023 and 2024, and later ETH. It didn't just lend legitimacy, it unlocked institutional access at scale. Today, BlackRock has become the single largest TradeFi driver of crypto adoption. It manages over $87 billion in the spot Bitcoin ETF assets and $10 billion in ETH ETFs. ETH, by the way, is Ethereum. BlackRock is also leading in DeFi adjustment areas. Its BUIDL fund, a tokenized U.S. Treasury fund, issued mostly on Ethereum via Securitize, holds over $2.4 billion, almost 10%, of the $25 billion tokenized asset market on-chain. It's a direct example of TradeFi using DeFi infrastructure without compromising regulatory standards. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan's Kinexys division is working to bring financial assets on-chain. It has tested on-chain FX, repo, and tokenized bonds using permissioned DeFi liquidity pools. It is building infrastructure that mimics DeFi mechanics while staying within institutional rails. This isn't a crypto experiment. It's the beginning of institutional DeFi. Then there's Fidelity, long known for its crypto-forward stance, which is quietly expanding its digital assets platform and exploring staking, custody, and tokenized financial products. It has the trust of pension funds and family offices, the very cohort most likely to embrace DeFi once it's wrapped in a familiar product interface. Fidelity could lead by building regulated DeFi index products or permission vaults for clients. Goldman Sachs and BNY Mellon are also making moves with pilot projects to tokenize money market funds with fast settlement and interoperability across digital networks. Goldman's private blockchain and BNY's Liquidity Direct are testing tokenized fund redemptions, a gateway to replicating DeFi yield mechanics inside TradeFi. Not every TradeFi sector, though, is equally ripe for a shift to DeFi. The two verticals where adoption is most likely to break through are the asset management and treasury markets, as well as the securities lending and repo markets. Tokenized treasuries, like BlackRock's BUIDL, are just the beginning. Expect asset managers to create programmable yield products, combining DeFi vault strategies with real-world assets. This is attractive for institutions sitting on large cash balances because DeFi native strategies offer higher yields and transparent collateralization. On the lending and repo side, DeFi can enable instant, auditable, and programmable collateral exchanges with reduced counterparty risk. JP Morgan's experiments in tokenized repo trading are just the start. A permissioned version of Aave or Morpho could gain traction here. Just as crypto exchanges wrapped peer-to-peer transactions in slick UX, TradeFi needs to wrap DeFi in user-friendly and compliant interfaces. That's the blueprint for TradeFi and DeFi collaboration. TradeFi doesn't need to reinvent the wheel, but it can add polish, regulatory clarity, and scale to existing DeFi primitives. Custodians can integrate liquid staking. Banks can offer tokenized money market funds on-chain. Asset managers can issue yield-bearing DeFi vaults with KYC wrappers. All of the ingredients are in place. For now, TradeFi has the balance sheets and DeFi has the blueprints. The future belongs to those who build the bridge. Next, we're going to talk about Generation Z people and how they view careers. This is from Fortune magazine, dated August 2nd by Meredith Ho. The title of the article is Gen Z Content Creators Are Bringing in Millions from Their Side Hustles and Questioning the Need for a College Degree. When Gen Alpha dreams about the future, fewer and fewer are imagining the white lab coat or briefcase wishes of their parents. Instead, they see ring lights and Get Ready With Me videos. In fact, the two top career aspirations among Generation Alpha across the United States are YouTuber and TikTok creator, according to a 2024 WAP survey. And many young people are already turning their dreams into a reality including 19-year-old Katie Fang. The recent high school graduate boasts 6.4 million followers on TikTok and is most known for her popular videos showcasing how she starts her mornings, as well as showcasing brand deal trips and her recent move to New York City from Vancouver, Canada. Even though she's already seemingly got a jump start on her career, Fang is set to attend New York University in the fall, where she will focus on upgrading her digital marketing skills. Fang told Fortune that pursuing a college education will help her think more critically and creatively, especially when crafting content and understanding how platforms like TikTok's algorithm work. "I think I've always known that I was going to stay in school. I never really took a break. I was online for 2 years, so it kind of felt like I wasn't in school, but I was," Fang told Fortune. "I wanted to go to NYU for the longest time. Just because I started social media and it became my full-time career doesn't mean that dream ever faded." Fang's long-term goal is to start a business after college and to continue to build a personal brand. "I think the most important thing is just don't rush to have it all figured out, because especially when you're so young, you're not going to know everything," she said. Since starting her TikTok account in Canada, Fang hasn't earned revenue directly from her videos. Instead, the majority of her income comes from brand partnerships with companies like Glow Recipe, The Ordinary, and Kosas. "What I enjoy most is probably how creative everything is," Fang says. "It's crazy how you can make the most random video that makes no sense and that ends up being the one that gets millions of views." Fang is just one example of how young people have been able to turn a passion project into a runaway for high-paying career where they are their own boss. This comes as a growing number of Generation Zs are questioning the value of a degree to begin with. Recent data shows the unemployment rate for men aged 22 to 27 is almost the same, regardless of whether they have a college degree. If you've ever scrolled through YouTube, chances are you've probably come across viral sensations like, "I survived the 5 deadliest places on Earth," or the high-stakes Beast Game Challenges, videos that have each garnered over 100 million views. The mastermind behind these social phenomenon is a 27-year-old Jimmy Donaldson, better known as Mr. Beast, who also holds the crown as the most subscribed creator on the platform. A self-made YouTuber whose net worth now exceeds $1 billion, Donaldson began creating and sharing content at just 13 years old. He later dropped out of East Carolina University in 2016 after just a few weeks of courses to pursue content creation full-time. Since its launch in 2012, Mr. Beast's channel has skyrocketed in popularity thanks to breakout hits like Squid Game and Real Life, which racked up over 845 million views. In a recent episode of the Diary of a CEO podcast, Donaldson told host Stephen Bartlett that he discovered his motivation to pursue content creation on YouTube when he found out creators were making a high income a year. "Growing up without much financial stability, he was driven by a desire to support his mother and his family. This is what I love doing. I've never had as much joy doing something I do as this," Donaldson said. "I just never give up. There's no world where I would ever quit. When I was 11, I just said I'm going to be a YouTuber, and I'm going to die trying, and I meant it. Even if there was no one still watching my videos to this day, I would still be going. I'm just the most competitive, stubborn person you'll ever meet." At first, Donaldson's mother did not want her son to pursue a career in social media because she wanted him to be successful and encouraged him to pursue a college degree instead. "When people told me I can't do something, it makes me want to do more," Donaldson said. "If you tell me I shouldn't do something, that's fine. But if you tell me I can't, then everything in my body just wants to go." Donaldson is not alone in using social media as a source of income and as a career. According to social commerce platform WAP, 42% of U.S. teens are actively earning money online through their digital channels. Another content creator who did not go through the traditional college pathway is Olaida Olayinka-Williams, better known as KS1. He is a 32-year-old British influencer, professional boxer, musician, and entrepreneur. He also founded businesses such as Prime Hydration, Lunchly, and Misfits Boxing, and has a net worth of $100 million. Joining YouTube in 2009, and initially posting videos of himself playing games, Williams built a following of over 50 million across all his platforms. Unlike his peers, Williams decided not to pursue college at all in favor of his blossoming content creation career, in part after realizing how much he was earning before attending university. I remember I asked a teacher, "This is how much I made this month." It was about £1,500. And I remember him telling me, "That's more than I make," Williams told the BBC in 2020. I looked at it and thought, "That's it. YouTube is the one. It is the gold mine. I need to push and push because I know I can become something and make my parents proud." It's becoming easier than ever to start a career as a content creator and make a living without a college degree. All in all you need is a phone to get started. Successful content creators who didn't go through a traditional educational pathway all share a common trait: building a community so highly engaged that they can rely on their continued support for exposure, said University of Southern California communications professor Freddie Nager. It's important that you try to cultivate your fan base. Otherwise, the only way to reach your followers is to boost your posts and buy ads, Nager told Fortune. A lot of people didn't become creators to spend money. They wanted to make money, but the platforms want to make money. Many creators build their email lists so they can directly notify followers when a new video is released, often encouraging them to watch and leave a comment. He also suggested that creators interact with followers in the comment section, something that is favorable to algorithms. You want your users to comment on your posts, because if they do, it means they really care, Nager said. Now, the comment could be negative. They could hate your video. Nonetheless, the algorithm reads it that if you're willing to take the time to comment on the video, not just liking it. So this means that your content must provoke comments. Sadly, that means a lot of influence become controversial on purpose. This type of collaboration is a key strategy for building influence and trust without a degree requirement. Nager also advised new creators to partner with others, regardless of their fame, emphasizing that exposure to each other's audiences helps both grow. In addition, he said that to stand out, creators need two key traits: personality and perspective. They must be relatable yet aspirational, offering a unique voice and sharing their human side to form real connections. Otherwise, they risk being replaced by generic content. While a formal education isn't required to break into the industry, Nager said, it offers key advantages. I think you need an education to learn from your mistakes without suffering. We can all learn from suffering, but let's avoid it. Let's learn how to analyze data, he explained. And while ultimately content creators can and have succeeded without degrees, Nager said more education can also expand one's worldview and creativity outside of your path. Can you be educated without college? Possibly, if you love to read, he said. But college lets you explore courses outside your field. Take astronomy if you're a writer, or music if you're a scientist. It doesn't mean that you're going to become a musical expert, but something about music may change the way that you think about chemistry and performance. We're going to finish the day with a series of short articles now. This is all from Fortune magazine, dated August 4th. Here's the first one. President Donald Trump's tariffs on nearly all key U.S. trading partners will go into effect on Thursday, a week later than his self-imposed deadline of August 1st. The president signed an executive order last week, updating the tariff rates for 67 countries, the European Union and Taiwan ranging from 10 to 41%. The new order does not cover rates for China or Mexico, both of which are still engaging with the United States on trade talks. Trump hit Switzerland with a steep 39% levy, a move that could impact the prices of many luxury goods and medical devices. Switzerland exported nearly $61 billion in goods to the United States last year, including timepieces from some of the world's finest watchmakers, such as Rolex, Omega, and others. Around 3,200 workers at Boeing's St. Louis Defense Factory went on strike as of midnight Monday after rejecting a contract offer Sunday afternoon that would have raised wages by 20%. It's the first walkout at this facility since 1996, though Boeing faced a larger machinist strike last year in Washington. Despite beating expectations for second quarter revenue and earnings per share, Amazon stock had dipped 8% by market close on Friday, after investors were spooked by modest third quarter earnings guidance and increased cloud and AI competition from Microsoft and Google. Tariff impacts on Amazon retail prices remain to be seen. As CEO Andy Jassy said, it's impossible to know what will happen. Here's the last one from the day. This is dated August 6th from Forbes magazine. The way President Donald Trump talks about his search for the next chair of the Federal Reserve is starting to sound like casting for an episode of The Apprentice. While Jerome Powell's term doesn't end until May 2026, the president's continued criticism over the Fed's refusal to ease interest rates has shifted to open consideration for who could take over once Powell is out the door. In an interview with CNBC on Tuesday, Trump said that his list of candidates to lead the Fed has been narrowed to four names, including former Fed Governor Kevin Warsh and National Economic Council Director Kevin Hassett. One name you can cross off the list, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who the president said wants to stay right where he is. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11.